This is Ben Clemmer, producer of WBOI Presents. Thank you for listening to this panel discussion found on WBOI.org. Before moderator Andy Downs continues, a reminder that you can listen to WBOI Presents every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. and every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. You just might hear a local panel discussion like this one. Thanks.
One of the other alternative forms of diplomacy, it's actually in the title, so we have to cover it a little bit, would be assassination. This came up recently, obviously, with the attempts on Sergei and Yulia Skripal. Russia has denied doing anything, and just about everybody else has said, no, there's plenty of evidence that says this is you. Do countries take credit for assassinations? Anne?
The denial thing, I just want to say that, I mean, Russia has reached a point where on state media, they say, they're basically saying, we totally didn't do it, but if we did it, wouldn't that be cool? So denial is kind of a very strong, right? I mean, we didn't, right? But if we did, what a cool, you know, what an amazing, amazing thing it would have been if we only did it. So kind of denial is a strong word for their position on
not fully acknowledging.
Right.
How's that?
Okay. Well, I mean, and they filed a complaint with the British, the Russian embassy in the UK filed a complaint that now that the Skripals actually are doing better, that the Russian embassy representative is not allowed to visit them in the
right.
hospital, like a formal complaint that, you know, as Russian citizens, they should be able to have access to them to see how they're doing, because somebody's clearly out to get them, and so they need to really check on them as much as possible. But more seriously about kind of the question of admitting, I mean, in some ways, it goes to how kind of the audience that you have. And I think the public statements to the West versus the statements within Russia kind of signify that there are different goals here, right? For internally, you want to be able to show off to your people how clever their government is, how much better their government is than everybody else. So there's a kind of to the loyalists, right, to shore up their enthusiasm that we're doing great. And especially right now when Russia's international standing is somewhat precarious, to be able to demonstrate that Russia is still a superpower is very important. But it's also kind of important without officially acknowledging, which could potentially lead to more international sanctions. There's also the sense that it's a show of force, right? A show of force to anybody who may be thinking about disagreeing with the government, may be thinking about defecting, may be thinking of doing whatever. They will get you. They can get you anywhere, and nobody can do anything about it. And I think so in that sense, the public, a certain amount of public acknowledgement, or at least kind of the allowing the implication to stand, is part of this strategy, right? You only have to hurt one person, but it potentially affects so many other people as far kind of in curbing dissent, criticism, spying, you know, whatever you're trying to curb.
Lachlan, would you say were there attempts to take credit, or, as Anne has put it, almost take credit?
Yeah, I think there, again, because of the complex nature of this, there were all sorts of opportunities for assassination to be used. And in fact, there in Northern Irish parlance, to give someone the message was meant to kill them. And so that idea of assassination as a sort of message delivery system is very much a part of every aspect of it, from the targeting of their own sort of disloyal or no longer useful agents to people that they saw as threats, whether they be sort of military, as Gerry Adams was considered, or even sort of someone like famously sort of broke one of these moments of the sort of visible nature of collusion between paramilitaries and the state was a human rights solicitor called Pat Finucane in Northern Ireland, who was assassinated. The person who ordered the assassination was an agent of British intelligence. And so the idea was that this guy was getting too good at his job, he was getting too many people off, and was seen as that much of a threat that they would get rid of them, as kind of a message to everyone else, is how many would view it. In the subsequent sort of investigations, there were several, the Stevens reports, some things that seemed to come out was that when things like this come known, there might be ulterior motives for this to be happening in the first place. For example, you have to look at who benefits from the revelation of this. Mm. One of the things that happens from the investigation of the collusion between various intelligence groups and loyalist paramilitaries is that MI5 gets to consolidate power over formerly kind of semi-independent groups. And so a lot of intelligence analysts would say that, well, is there something else big picture going on beyond just the revelation of these sort of assassination ploys here? And so who benefits, who doesn't benefit is often depends on who you ask, right?
Well, and I maybe should have started, what is the goal of the assassination? Right. I guess maybe I should have started there. Are there unifying goals? Are there a limited number of goals that are usually found?
Well, I'd say, I mean, in terms of purpose, and if I look at intelligence as assassinations as carried out by intelligence agencies, since I'm the espionage person here, you know, if it's an alternative form of diplomacy, the goals are either you're trying to avoid overt war, so or not seem like you're weak and not accomplishing your own goal. So it really is a gray area. It really is the alternative form. So, you know, an example that came to mind when I was thinking about this is the CIA's attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro. And, you know, Castro, he's this communist dictator literally in the United States backyard, and he is just, you know, a thorn in their side, and the United States can't stand him, but they don't want to actually go to war with him, but they also don't want to just let him sit there and boisterously insult capitalism and insult the United States. So they go with this alternative means, the middle area of trying to assassinate him. Now, you know, the irony, they basically fail over and over and over again. They fail to overthrow him famously during the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And then there's a claim made by one of Castro's bodyguards that the CIA tried to assassinate him 638 times. And I wrote down some of the great assassination attempts included poisoning him with botulism toxin, cigars, giving him a diving suit that was prepared that would be infected with a fungus that would cause this chronic and debilitating skin disease. A booby-trapped conch placed at the bottom of the sea, an exploding cigar. You know, that's almost like the exploding bats.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it's bats, yeah.
Other things that weren't assassination, but they were going to slip him these thallium salts to destroy his beard because that's his sign of, you know, manliness and power. So if his hair falls out, lo and behold. Another one, lace his radio studio with LSD so that he sounds crazy when he's there. So, you know, all these attempts, 638 probably is certainly an exaggeration. But in the 1970s, when the Church Committee reviews a lot of the kind of way, you know, the practices of the CIA that they'd been carrying out during the 50s and 60s, they did substantiate, I think, at least 8 assassination attempts on Castro. And so there's this image that I pulled up that just makes me laugh all the time of Castro holding up this newspaper about a plot to kill him and laughing. And he, you know, he famously says in regards to all these attempts on his life that he believed, quote, if surviving assassination attempts were an Olympic event, I would win the gold medal. So the fact that this gets revealed and that's out there, not only does it not help the United States advance their cause of getting rid of this communist leader, but it gives Castro more power, more legitimacy, more authority in the eyes of his people, and it makes the Americans look bad that they can't even get rid of this one guy.
Anne?
Well, and this is a great illustration of the problems of democracy. You know, if the Soviet Union wanted to assassinate someone and they weren't successful, nobody would have to know about it, right? And so this is kind of this is what allows, I think, strategies. I mean, I know I was perhaps too blasé, especially followed by Lachlan's example of kind of the really horrible strategies used for spying. So while spying, it is what it is. But I think once we move to assassinations, I think this is where the situation really changes dramatically. And so when you have kind of a, when you have a closed regime, a repressive, you know, a repressive regime, it makes it that much easier for them to deploy assassination. But it also makes them it makes it easier for them to control the impact, right? So you have the elimination of a particular person, you have the terror that it inspires in others who might follow suit, you have the demonstration of power. Again, especially, I mean, during the Cold War, it wasn't quite as important. I think now it's much more important for Russia to be able to show that it's still a major player. So these kinds of things, without the subsequent revelations about things that went wrong, this is what allows the assassinations to have the kind of the extra power as an alternative for, you know, as an alternative form of diplomacy, because there's really almost no, it's a win-win for, you know, for a regime that doesn't have to worry about disclosures as far as deploying this as a strategy.
We certainly are much more aware of these things today than we had been, and there are a number of posters for us to look at that are basically propaganda or getting the public involved, and you found a number of these. The first one we're looking at, could you describe
this? This is an American one. So this is a kind of a genre in World War I, World War II, and a little bit during the Cold War, at least on the Soviet side, kind of the don't talk, right? Loose lips, you know, sink ships and so on. So this is an American one, right? Kind of the assumption that the enemy might be watching, and so vigilance is necessary. Sorry, the Soviet one, be vigilant, and in the upper right-hand corner, it says, you know, you have to be vigilant because, you know, everything you say, rumors and gossip, there's a short distance between rumors and gossip to treason. So this is kind of with the invention of, with the telephone becoming more prominent, people who blather on the phone are assistants to the fascist spies. And this is kind of, again, this keeps going, right? Don't talk on the phone. You will be a great find for a spy. This is now we're moving into the Cold War, right? Kind of this, the duality, the seemingly normal person that you're telling gossip to is really an enemy. And you can see, he's the enemy because he has a monocle, which is kind of
a visual cue
that this person is, is the enemy. And this is now 1961, right? Again, kind of the enemy is watching. And so you have to be vigilant. This is one of my favorites. I think the British ones are the cutest, yeah. If I can say that about, you know, propaganda. But there's a lot of them, kind of the careless talk costs lives. And there's one with a bus where Hitler is sitting behind you while you were talking. And here, of course, the walls have ears. And you can see that the ears, hopefully if you look closely, right, you can see that they're little Hitler faces, right? Those are the ears, that are potentially watching. And this is the way in which you can see that while the actual spine, it should be left to professionals. There's a way of just like, part of when we talk about total war of the 20th century isn't government ensuring that everybody's involved in some capacity, even with spying, even if you don't have the skill set to do the actual spy, you can still do your part by preventing the other side from potentially getting information.
And these posters actually are very interesting to look at. Some of them are done quite nicely. You have to look kind of hard to see some things, not so hard to see some other things. But we are much more aware of this than ever before, and there is a whole genre of literature now, in part maybe because we're aware of things. What's the appeal of the literature, do you think?
Well, first of all, I would say that now spy literature is not new. I think it dates back to at least before World War I. But the appeal of spy literature, I think, first of all, just kind of who doesn't love murder and intrigue and scandal? You know, that's one thing. But I think it's appealing in that if it's written well, it very much reflects the anxieties, the reality as of the time. And this is why, you know, historians, we actually love studying literature, because I can go back, for example, to look at British spy literature of the late 19th century, and I can see what it was that the population was preoccupied. And in this case, the spy literature pre-World War I actually fuels the development of counter-espionage agencies. You have these authors saying, Why, look, there's spies everywhere, and you should write in and tell me about the spies you see. And they receive all these letters, and it happens to be one of these novelists that's friends with a guy who works at the fledgling MI5, and they do set up this counter-espionage agency. So, yeah, I think the appeal is very much it reflects what we're thinking. Everybody likes books that kind of make you think and make you feel, oh, it's just like me.
Lachlan?
Yeah, and I would agree completely with all of that. And then in terms of the sort of fictitious examples of it, the, you know, what side of your reptilian brain doesn't sort of secretly like the James Bond coolness and license to kill on the fictional side. But of course, as I've hopefully emphasized, that bears very little to the reality of the situation. But there is that sort of allure to it, right? That's been there for so long.
Mm-hmm.
During the Soviet period, kind of the Soviet regime had a difficult relationship with spy literature because anything that smacked too much of kind of the concern was that it would be too escapist, right? And so it would be too popular. Anything that's too popular becomes problematic. But at the same time, certain kinds of spy literature, could be educational, right? And so there are a couple of there aren't a lot of really kind of classics, but there are a couple, usually dealing with spies, kind of a very famous one that was made into a movie where the spy was somebody who was embedded in the upper echelons of the Nazi state, and so kind of he is living there while World War II is going on. The spy literature now is kind of, I would say that there are some that are truly literature, and then there's a lot of pulp literature that really kind of appeals to, again, the lowest common denominator, usually the evil Americans, right, doing awful things and being vanquished in various ways and defeated because, of course, they're all stupid and the Russian and their Russian counterparts, are not.
Well, I'm going to open the floor up to questions, but while I'm walking out to hand the mic to somebody, any particular author, fact or fiction that you would suggest people take a look at?
I'll tell you one of my favorites. I mean, I actually don't read very much spy literature, probably because I'm reading the histories of it too much. But Graham Greene, who did work for British intelligence, I think in the 50s maybe, one of my favorites by him is called Our Man in Havana. And I like that one. It's actually a satire of spy literature. And the story kind of follows a guy that almost is similar to this Agent Garbo, Pujols Garcia, that I was talking about, who he's actually a vacuum salesman, but he needs some extra money, and so he sends back all these detailed diagrams and just makes up all these stories about the spies in his circle back to London from Cuba, and they keep paying him and financing him. So that's a good one for you to check out.
Anyone else?
He's a contemporary Russian writer. His name is Boris Akunin, Akunin, and he is writing about pre-World War I Russian spies. But this is sort of, he is the thinking person spy literature, right? This is not the pulp that, commoners read, right? It's very interesting, kind of perhaps more as a reflection of contemporary Russia than anything else. But, and it's, of course, a series of books.
Two quick authors. One on the nonfiction end of things, Martin Dillon, is I can't recommend highly enough for Northern Irish stuff. He has a couple of books, The Dirty War and The Trigger Men, both of which get into much more detail of the things I touched on today. And then on the fiction side, Owen McNamee has a couple of awesome books out there of historical fiction, The Ultras, which centers on a real-life person, Robert Nirach, who was disappeared in Northern Ireland, and then Resurrection Men, which is a sort of fictionalization of the actual paramilitary group, the Shankill Butchers. And as odd as it might seem, he actually treats the subject with poetic language, as odd as that seems, but as good a sort of fictional historical fiction of the topic as you can get, I think.
Questions? Do you have a couple questions?
With the state, with our country being in, and really the state of the world, how do you think things like Alexa and Siri are going to maybe be part of that? How do we go from not talking about things to anyone to asking these things that pretty much anybody can have access to?
In some ways, I think the problem for intelligence agencies these days is now a glut of information.
Right.
So, yes, it is terrifying that we carry around these little devices where we can be tracked everywhere. We write a million emails spilling, where we are, what we're going, what we're thinking. So, yes, it is terrifying that our thoughts, no matter what, the electronic device we're speaking into or writing into, makes us trackable. But I think it's a huge challenge for intelligence in that, you know, it's now a needle in the haystack. In intelligence parlance, you have signals and noise, and it's just how do you get anything out of it? And I think this is a problem. You know, how do you find real terrorists or real criminals when, you know, you're reading about someone like me talking about espionage, but just for an academic purpose?
I'll do something different, and I'll be optimistic. I'm gonna say things like Alexa and Siri. Maybe it's actually part of a plot to prevent other governments from being innovative, right? Because they think, oh, look, you don't have to innovate and come up with new strategies of decrypting information. It's all right here. And so as a result, it can contribute to the decline in the innovative technology that is deployed against America.
One more question.
I'm interested if you have any thoughts about, I guess what I'm thinking of it as is like third-party roles in espionage. So maybe that, you know, there's this, you know, the major conflict are between two big actors. But I imagine with the information out there that, you know, a country or even an individual may come across something that's really potent information. And I wonder, does that happen? Is that a thing? Or maybe not?
Almost stumbling onto to the big find. Deborah, can you think of an example where somebody who was not involved directly happened to find the big piece of data that was useful?
I mean, the only thing that comes to mind is, and I'm not sure if it's even third party, is the Zimmerman telegram, which was a letter written from Germany to the United States. And it happened to be the British who were intercepting German lines looking for something totally different that found this offer proffered by the British government to Mexico the German government during World War I to Mexico, saying, if you join World War I on the side of Germany, will help you get Texas back. And when the British find this, and it's actually a big scandal because the British cannot tell the Americans that they have this document, because the way they got it was basically tapping into the American embassy, which Britain and the United States were allies, so they aren't supposed to admit that they've been bugging, wiretapping, whatever it might be, into the American embassy. So they do inadvertently come across this, you know, amazing document, and America is neutral at this point, right? This is while America isn't in the war. So the British know this is a huge find, and they know they want to let the Americans know that they've found this valuable piece of information, and they have to go back through channels and get somebody in Mexico City to go buy the telegram from the Western Union office and say, this is how we got it, rather than we found it through wiretapping the embassy in Washington. So I'm not sure if that's exactly what you had in mind, but that was a big inadvertent find during World War I.